This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of March 9th, 2025. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 386. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. Hear from the head of a vital charity in Surrey, BC. And on the big deal feature, it is the end of the Justin Trudeau era. Trudeau must go and make way for a new Liberal leader as Canada moves one big step closer to a federal election. Looking back at one of Canada's most controversial and most consequential prime ministers, my guest is Tom Korski, the managing editor of Blacklock's Reporter. This is the big deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. In fall 2015, Justin Trudeau and the Liberal Party came to power with a majority election win.
Sunny ways, my friends, sunny ways.
There were two more minority election results in 2019 and 2021 in favor of the Liberals, but since 2022, Trudeau has needed help from the NDP to stay in power. On January 6, 2025, he finally announced resignation after years of declining popularity and scandal after scandal.
This country deserves a real choice in the next election, and it has become clear to me that if I'm having to fight internal battles, I cannot be the best option in that election.
Trudeau is going out of office during a trade war with Donald Trump. The Liberals will choose their new leader and prime minister after this week's podcast premieres. Mark Carney is heavily favored. To talk about this, my guest is Tom Korski, the managing editor of Blacklock's Reporter. You can find it at blacklocks.ca. It is named for the early 20th century press gallery reporter and war correspondent Tom Blacklock. It's all about minding Ottawa's business, and nobody does it like Blacklock's does it day after day, the best accountability journalism out of the nation's capital. Tom Korski is a veteran newspaper and radio reporter from Brandon, Manitoba. He covered the Alberta legislature for the Calgary Sun, and he also worked for the South China Morning Post in Beijing. So here we are on this pivotal weekend in Canadian history when Justin Trudeau is on his way out of office. He came to power nearly a decade ago, promising balanced budgets and a new way of voting. He promised first past the post was finished. He also promised disclosure by default, a new era of sunshine and accountability. Instead, his legacy includes subsidized childcare and legalized marijuana stores. I started by asking Tom Korski of Blacklock's Reporter what he thinks Justin Trudeau's legacy will be.
Well, thanks for having me, Bob. I can think of a couple of things. One is, it's always difficult in the moment when everyone's hot and angry to answer that question, isn't it? I remember when Harper left, and I didn't think then that people like me, reporters, gave him enough credit for some of the things he did that only became obvious with the passage of time. He created, for instance, the Parliamentary Budget Office. He established the Ombudsman for Contracting. He passed a Financial Accountability Act that made it easier to mine the dollars. He famously expanded the Access to Information Act to cover Crown corporations. Well, that all sounds like inside baseball. Bob, that saved taxpayers a fortune, but it wasn't obvious in the time. Is it possible Trudeau did something amazing that in this moment when everyone's hot and angry, we don't see? Sure, I'm not a fortune teller. You ask me at this moment, I think his great legacy is laziness. I think he's one of the laziest men I ever saw, and certainly one of our laziest prime ministers. You talk to anybody who runs anything, my two cents, a small business, a union local, a minor hockey club. What do they do? They solve problems morning, noon, and night. That's all they ever do. It's like they're born that way. And this prime minister wasn't interested in that. He famously testified at the China inquiry. He couldn't be bothered reading security memos from the Canadian Security Intelligence Service or the police. He was handed one memo. They called them briefing notes, Bob. briefing. I mean, they're only 6 to 9 pages long. If you're really in a jam, you can just read the first paragraph and the last paragraph and get the gist of it. He wasn't interested, even when it came to Chinese interference. He was not going to solve small problems. And guess what? They became big ones. This is the cabinet that literally couldn't run a budget office. There was a detachment from day-to-day operations that was just spectacular. I think Canadians are going to be paying for that for a long, long time.
How, from your point of view, has Parliament changed under Trudeau? How has it changed for you as a reporter to cover these institutions?
I think the minority parliaments were saving grace. I really do. It stopped a lot of shenanigans, and the committees became red hot. We always say anytime you elect a minority parliament, you say, hang on to your wallet. Like, this is going to get very expensive. Minority parliaments are famous spendthrifts. They can go through billions like no one's business. But the cabinet did not have the votes from 2019 to exercise all its powers and run its various schemes. And there were committees that did a spectacular service. And I say that left, right, or center. Bob, if you're an ordinary Canadian, your MP, whether you voted for that person or not, it's the only voice you have in Parliament. Trust me, you cannot talk to federal public service managers. Good luck talking to Cabinet. You'll never get through security. Your MP is the only person you have. And there were MPs who determined that, for instance, during the pandemic days, famously Cabinet, Borton spent $500 billion. The finances are just a mess. And there were MPs who chased those dollars. And they found a lot of shenanigans, misfeasance that has led to RCMP investigations. Once again, we're out to save money. And I think that has been a hallmark. There's been a higher standard of committee investigations in the last two parliaments than I've seen in a long, long time. A lot of that was circumstance, as I mentioned. There were even moments where the Liberals would filibuster their own committees to stop motions for further investigations. But I think those committees really, they set a standard. It's very difficult to go back to sleep in the old committee days.
How has Justin Trudeau been able to last this long, to get into a 10th year? Where did everything finally go wrong? Was it calling the election in the middle of the pandemic in 2021, halfway through his second term when he didn't need to?
It was Toronto, Toronto, Toronto. I mean, they won 25 of 25 seats in Toronto. Toronto is the most liberal city in the country, and that's a lot of seats. And that ensured that they had just enough to hang on after the SNC-Lavalin scandal, as you mentioned, after 2019. That kept them around. And isn't it interesting, is it a coincidence, that the Liberal Party only started to run that guy out of town on a rail after they lost a by-election in Toronto? And you say, well, Tom, surely it can't be that narrow a focus. Oh, you bet. The Liberal plurality, the popular vote for the Liberals in Toronto, was over 52%. They don't come anywhere close in any other municipality in the country. You mentioned the pandemic election. You talk about far-reaching legacies, bright or dark. Did you know before the 2021 election, and we only can determine this, ironically, because of one of the provisions of the Financial Accountability Act that was passed by Stephen Harper way back in 2006. It was one line in a bill, Bob, and it said, if you spend money on public opinion polling charged to the taxpayer, you must report the findings to the taxpayer. Now, you have to know where to look. They don't make it easy. But we have mined this. It's been gold. Before the 2021 pandemic election, they did a word I've never heard before. They did psychographic polling. This is on the level, psychographic polling. And they determined that there was a certain segment of the population, typically it was younger working age women and seniors, who were afraid to die. You remember those days? You had to wear a mask and get a vaccine, or it could mean that they were petrified. And then they determined that there was a segment of the population, landed immigrants, typically working, the factory class, working people, and some suburbanites, who were more upset by government overreach. And they did the math. And that man ran the most divisive election campaign I think Canada has ever seen in peacetime by a sitting prime minister. You remember where he described people who opposed his program. He completely changed his mind on mandates. You were a bad parent. You were an unfit parent. You were racist. You were a misogynist. That was all contrived as hell, Bob. They did the polling on that, and they went into Toronto with that research data on psychographic polling and fears, and they farmed it, and it worked. You can only do that once, but he did it.
Now, the Trudeau era will be known for lots of scandals, the conflict of interest scandals. He stayed at the Aga Khan's place in the Bahamas in 2016, the SNC-Lavalin scandal in 2019, dumping Jody Wilson-Raybould from cabinet after she wouldn't agree to change the prosecution in favor of SNC-Lavalin. Then there was the We Charity scandal in 2020, the job program for youth. The 2019 election campaign, a different kind of scandal, the blackface photos that were revealed that would be damning for a lot of politicians, but not so much for Justin Trudeau. And then, of course, 2023, the leaks from CSIS carried by Globe and Mail and Global News about China's meddling in favor of the Liberals. Which of these scandals do you think is the one that defines the Trudeau era?
I think, Bob, that there are some that have, there's a common theme. You mentioned SNC-Lavalin. It was scandalous. And you mentioned We Charity. There's a commonality between those two. That was both implied a complex friendship between public office holders and federal contractors. Well, isn't that the old story that goes back 158 years? These guys took it to new levels. There was an absolute detachment. I attribute it to laziness, but the impact is corrupt practices. We don't like to use that word in Canada. We think of corruption as someone who walks into the mayor's office and throws some cash in a paper sack on the desk and says, I want the snowplow contract. It runs a lot of different ways. I think the cabinet, in its detachment from day-to-day operations, and it's frankly, forgive my language, its sleazy relationship with some federal contractors. It was obviously quid pro quo. We Charity gave the Prime Minister's family over $400,000 in gifts, free trips, and other payments in kind, talent fees. And in exchange, they got a sole source contract for over $43 million to run a national program they'd never run before. Well, there's a word for that. It's called conflict of interest. Inexplicably, the RCMP never even interviewed the Prime Minister on that. You can't do that at school board. Come on. SNC-Lavalin. There was a relationship between the Liberal Party and the Quebec engineering firm. It wasn't just a community of interest, Bob. You know, SNC-Lavalin had to plead out a guilty charge, 2 years less a day for whoever chump executive they sent down to the courthouse to plead it, for making over $100,000 in illegal campaign contributions to the Liberal Party. We're led to believe, in the limited disclosure of documents that we've seen, that Lavalin lobbyists pretty much had their boots on the desk at the Prime Minister's office. They ran that show. What happened as a result of all of this? Why do I think that's so far-reaching? Long after Trudeau leaves town. Because the tone comes from the top. You'll never guess what we discovered through some of those committee investigations and other access to information disclosures over the last 5 years, really. This started to filter down. This started to filter down all the way down to public service managers, and there started to run little scams that cabinet never even knew about. How is it possible that France spent $9 million on its ArriveCan app and ours cost $60 million? They ran those contracts through public service managers right up until the minute the cops busted down the door at the lead contractor's office with a warrant that said fraudulent billing. SNC-Lavalin pandemic. It was a call from a low-level manager in the Department of Industry to that firm that said, how would you like to get into the mobile hospital unit business? Nobody asked for a mobile hospital unit. Lavalin said, we don't really know anything about mobile unit hospitals. And then the guy at the Department of Ministry said it's $150 million. And Lavalin said, yes, I think we can throw together a few tents for you with some ventilators. They told the minister after the fact, Bob, my two cents, you've got a rotten public service at the top. No one has gone to jail. No one has been subpoenaed or testified under oath. If there is ever a judicial inquiry into pandemic contracting, we're one of the few G7 countries that hasn't had one. You hang on to your hat. I think some people are going to jail.
I mean, he's basically the pandemic prime minister, that would be known that way for decades to come as people look back in the history books. But social unrest, this has been an era of social unrest during the Trudeau era, like nothing else we've seen in Canada. Early in 2020, while Trudeau was campaigning around the world to get Canada a seat on the UN Security Council, back home here, the Shutdown Canada anti-pipeline protests. Then there was 2021, the Cancel Canada Day protests after the Tkemloops Band in Kamloops claimed they found remains of 215 children, since downgraded to 215 radar anomalies. No investigation, full investigation of that yet. And then, of course, the 2022 Freedom Convoy in Ottawa, and then the 2023-2024 pro-Hamas protests. Is social unrest in Canada like we've never seen before, some of it foreign interference, some of it just a lot of Canadians who are angry about things?
I think that's valid. I think there's one common thread, not the anti-Semitic protests. I think that's a policing matter, that, just my opinion. And I don't know why certain municipalities have tolerated it and others notably have not. The other issues you mention, you know, there used to be consensus is like seen for losers now in federally. It's seen as consensus building is seen as what weak, unprincipled people do. And it's not the case. What do I mean by that? You know, Mulroney, free trade. You lived through that. What did Mulroney do? How did he manage to convince Canadians to eliminate tariffs? A rich irony now. How fortunate are we that Brian Mulroney was not alive to see what happened to his legacy? What did he do? Well, he had a royal commission. Some people said that he ignored everything that came at public hearings at the royal commission, but that's fine. They had a royal commission, went right across the country, back and forth. Come one, come all. Come to the hall. Tell us what you think about tariffs and free trade. We're all ears. And then he wrote a bill, and he passed the bill. Come one, come all. Everyone, tell us what you think about free trade. We think this. But you be sure and get your two cents in. And then he had an election on it. And so by the time it came for the moment to pass this monumental change in the economic structure of our country, even people who opposed it would say, well, fair is square. You know, he won it fair and square. They don't do that anymore. He has, I'm referring now to the prime minister we have now. Trudeau decided the way it was going to be on key issues and to the point of the prorogation, which is almost unbelievable in a moment of national crisis. He called it a crisis, not my word, his crisis, that you would not have 338 voices speaking up for all those constituents specific to Atlantic in the House of Commons at this moment. They have, I think they find Parliament sort of a pain. I think they find public hearings, consultation sort of irritating and kind of slightly demeaning. You know the Freedom Convoy's problem, Bob? They wouldn't meet them. They made it a point they weren't going to dignify these people with their presence. I'll meet the Iranians, but I'm not going to meet some truck drivers from St. Agathe, Manitoba. One interesting epilogue to the Freedom Convoy and so many of these protests you describe. Canadians don't like that. We like, you know, live and let live. But there, I think there's an expectation of competent management. And you know what happened with the Freedom Convoy in the aftermath? It cost the mayor of Ottawa's job, the chief of police in Ottawa's job, the attorney general of Canada, and his deputy attorney general. It cost the commissioner of the RCMP her job. on and on down the list. All the people who used the hammer against the Freedom Convoy, when really all you had to do was get out of your chauffeured car and talk to them. They just weren't going to do it, and they're going to pay the price for that.
What are some of those stories of the Trudeau era that you're most proud of?
Well, we like to follow the money. When people say it's not about the money, we've never said that. It's always about the money. It's ethics. Money and ethics and power. And that's the 2,000-year-old story. And there have been numerous stories that have provided us that there's been some cussing and some cheering over some of those items. I have to say, though, on the broader theme, home equity tax, nothing comes close to it. The cabinet had a fetish about a home equity tax. It was not a mystery. They needed to pay off their deficits. And they looked at $3 trillion in paid-up equity, mother and father's bungalow, right across the country. And they said, if we could just get a little piece of that action, just a little piece, Bob, we can cover all our deficits and keep having our social engineering programs. We'd never have to raise a tax. And we found out about that through various friends and associates who started filing access to information. Others joined in. It is, I will go to my grave telling my children how proud we are that we did everything we could to stop these people from imposing a home equity tax, because we know, they put it in writing internally, they wanted to do it so badly. They couldn't resist. To this day, my blood pressure goes up just thinking about it. The blood, sweat, and tears that working people put into their homes in our country so that they will have some equity, so their kids can go to better schools than they ever went to, so that you don't die in the street when you're too old or sick to work all the time. The only thing you have that saves you from catastrophe in life is your little bungalow, and they were coming for it. I get worked up about it to this day. We watch like a hawk every document, every budget, every public accounts, every internal memo, home equity tax, never stopped.
One of the people that was the loudest voice in favor of that was Paul Kershaw of a group called Generation Squeeze.
Paul Kershaw, my God. God bless him.
This is the end of the line for Justin Trudeau and the start of the era of what many people predict will be the Mark Carney era. We won't know that until after this podcast airs, but I'm sure there'll be plenty of stories to talk about so we can shake our heads and laugh about this thing called Canada.
It's a conveyor belt of mediocrity and misfeasance in Ottawa, Bob. It'll never end.
Thanks for joining me on the Breaker.News podcast. Tom Korski, he's the managing editor of Blacklock's Reporter. Go to blacklocks.ca, and if you can, do subscribe. It's accountability journalism at its finest from the nation's capital. I don't think anyone else knows what's going on in Ottawa as much as the team at blacklocks.ca. Thanks again.
Oh, thank you, Bob.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In FocusTaiwan.tw, Taiwan, Italy, Inc. revised aviation pact, paving way to increased flights. The agreement builds on the original pact established in 2009. Under the revised agreement, passenger flight capacity could increase from 7 to 19 flights per week for each side, with Venice joining Rome and Milan as approved destinations. Cargo flights remain at 3 per week, but both sides have granted each other fifth freedom rights for two of those flights, meaning greater flexibility for cargo operations. In ABC News Australia, New Zealand sacks High Commissioner to UK over comments critical of Trump. New Zealand's most senior diplomat in London made remarks critical of U.S. President Donald Trump at an event this week. High Commissioner Phil Goff, a former Labour foreign minister, has been fired by New Zealand's right-leaning government. He quoted Churchill as saying to Chamberlain, "You had the choice between war and dishonor. You chose dishonor, yet you will have war." He then asked, President Trump has restored the bust of Churchill to the Oval Office, but do you think he really understands history? In Kyoto News, 108-year-old Japanese woman recognized as world's oldest female barber. Shitsui Hakoshi from Nakagawa, Tochigi Prefecture, received the Guinness Book of Records certificate. The 108-year-old obtained her barber's license in 1936. In 2021, she was a Tokyo Olympics torchbearer. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In Willamette Week, Clackamas County Commissioner charged with forging state lawmaker's signature while defrauding 83-year-old man. The Oregon Department of Justice says the alleged fraud occurred last September when Melissa Fireside was campaigning to unseat Mark Scholl. Fireside, a Democrat, was campaigning to unseat the former county commissioner, and an indictment says she defrauded a man of at least $74,000. In Crosscut, why are eggs so expensive in Washington right now? Local producers are taking precautions against avian flu, but people scrambling to buy might also be a factor in increased price and scarcity. A 2019 law requiring all eggs sold in Washington to be cage-free came into effect in January 2024, but Spokane Newsweekly, The Inlander, reported last year that the avian flu, inflation, increasing labor and materials prices, and the rising demand for eggs were also factors in last year's rising egg prices. And check out thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com for the stories behind these headlines. Exclusive! Crown dropped assault charges against convict accused of beating girlfriend in West Van Mansion for rent. And Mark Carney advised the BC NDP cabinet. And Ken Sims' January crypto crusade. Read the stories behind the headlines. Go to thebreaker.news or bobmackin.substack.com. That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
It don't matter what color you are, cause love will conquer hate, so you won't stand alone, you won't stand alone.
The Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to the Surrey Urban Mission Society, which is in its 30th year of helping the neediest in Surrey, BC. It does not get any easier due to social and economic headwinds and government cutbacks. I asked the CEO, Jack O'Halloran, about the Surrey Urban Mission Society, the services it provides, and the challenges it faces in 2025.
We've grown exponentially due to the people that are on the street. We started off as, you know, a little kitchen endeavor, trying to feed people, stuff like that. And then 25 years ago, as of next year, we were officially incorporated as, you know, so much more than just the little place that we were. And we are now presently five shelters, four of them being emergency shelters, one of them being a 60-bed supportive housing unit. And we've had a couple of programs that we've unfortunately lost in the past 6 months due to lack of funding. But we are about 155 beds, emergency shelter-wise, full all the time. And then, like I say, those 60 beds of supportive housing, which again are full all the time. You know, the new budget came out, and I would have to say that you hope when a budget comes out, it's a little bit more black and white, but this budget is so very, very gray. It's going to take an absolute genius to figure out how to interpret it. But at the end of the day, you know, our biggest worries are we really can't be upset with BC Housing, because the way it works is BC Housing gets the money from the provincial government. And if the provincial government is not filtering it down to them, it's not there. The city of Surrey, the city of Surrey really doesn't have a mandate for homelessness. They try to do what they can. But again, if the federal or provincial government doesn't step up to support the municipality, there's very little that they can do as well. So, you know, we have just lost two major programs. And what really worries me, Bob, is the fact that these programs were even pre-shelter. So these programs, one was a hygiene unit, which was just right over here on 105 A Street, just off of King George. It was a washroom facility, shower facility, laundry facility, and our community connection workers worked out of that facility so that people on the street, not people in shelter, people on the street, you know, at the lowest level, could get clean, could go to the washroom, could do their laundry. Worked out very, very well. That closed the end of September due to lack of funding. In our Surrey Welcome Hub, which is at Bentley Road in King George, we have a very interesting facility. We have our community connection workers, we have a 16-bed shelter, and we have a community kitchen that serves 200 meals a day to 200 people, breakfast and lunch every day of the week, also providing washrooms. That is closing as of the end of March because there's no funding. So all programs for people on the street, even before you get into a shelter, are effectively closing down.
Where can people find out more information about the society and the work you do, and how can people help?
Well, I'll tell you, we're always looking for financial donations and donations of clothing and food. So www.sumsplace.ca. Also, big call out for volunteers, always looking for help.
And you can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send me an email to Bob at thebreaker.news. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of March 9th, 2025. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 9th of March in 1959, the Barbie doll debuted at the New York City Toy Fair? And in 1961, on the 9th of March, the Soviet Sputnik 9 rocket launched with a dog and a dummy aboard. Now you know. Send me your feedback, send me your story ideas to Bob at thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. And introducing bobmackin.substack.com. Visit me there too. Sign up for the free email newsletter and get updates to your inbox, or follow The Breaker News for news as it happens on X, formerly Twitter. And you can support The Breaker for as little as $7 a month. For more information, go to bobmackin.substack.com.
Until next week.